Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, S.K. Perry, author of Let Me Be Like Water. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Could you tell us and introduce our listeners and entice them to be readers of Let Me Be Like Water to the story of Let Me Be Like Water?
Yeah, definitely. It's a very quiet story. It's about grief, really. It's the narrator is a young woman in her early 20s called Holly. And her, the very beginning of the story, her partner dies, who she's been with for 5 years. And the book just tracks the first year of her grief. And it's really written in the first person, but the second person voice is in there too. It's written to her boyfriend who's died, who's called Sam. And it's a book about, I guess, about trying to heal, and about all the ways that we avoid doing that too, and the ways we run away, and the ways that we try and escape from the things that we eventually have to feel to get better, I guess.
Yes, and it was funny. It evoked certain things for me. When I was 27, I was attacked, and it was the same sort of life-changing process of grief and growing up. And because when you're in your early 20s, hopefully you haven't had something as awful and as horrible as your partner dying, or you know, or something of that magnitude. And it is a time when you're quite self-involved and wrapped up in yourself, as you should be, I think, to a certain extent. And you also don't have the experience of, you know, happily you are not inured to grief, you know, as, you know, my mother, when going through the sort of list of people who lived in her community, said, that one died. You know, so hopefully in your 20s, you're not inured to this kind of grief. But for Holly, it is consuming, as her life with Sam was consuming.
Yeah. No, I definitely think that's true. I think two things that you say strike me. I mean, one is that whilst I did have a family death while I was writing the book, which fed into, I guess, writing a narrative of grief, I think, like, my own kind of very intense experience of grieving that I was processing during the book was also from being attacked. And I think that sudden change at a time when you're trying to work things out for yourself, and that kind of very extreme chaos that it throws you into when you haven't really found any stability to be chaotic from, I think is a lot of what is in the book. But also she is quite self-involved. And she's very young and naive and doesn't cope well with this big, big trauma that has happened to her, this bereavement. And I think one of the things I tried to do in the book was make her, like, at least a bit likable through that, like, self-centered, like, pain as well. Because, you know, when people are in pain, they're quite hard to be around. And she's the voice of the book. And she's a very intense voice of the book because we're with her pain all the time. So I guess that was, like, a challenge that I thought about while writing it. I don't know how much I succeeded. And, you know, pain's real. So also sometimes I think you just have to write that close to the bone as it is, you know.
She decides, after her boyfriend dies, that she cannot be, although with her we are quite immersed in the past and her life with Sam, we sort of relive that with her, but she cannot sit in London, surrounded by their life without him in it. So she up sticks and moves to Brighton.
Yeah. Which isn't that adventurous, to be honest. It's like an hour away on the train.
Yeah, but, you know, from London, it sometimes seems like, oh my God, you went to where?
I think sometimes to process something, we have to take a step away from it. And certainly I do think when something traumatic happens, sometimes really self-destructive instincts kick in. And I think that for Holly, like, cutting herself off from everyone who also loved Sam and was also grieving, everyone who loves her, everyone who could have provided her with, like, a really grounding way of processing the grief, she walks away from. And I think that's probably because she's just not ready to feel it. And so it seeps in, and at first it seeps in because she's thinking about their relationship, and slowly it seeps in because she starts to accept that he's gone. And as she does that, she kind of reconnects with people from their shared life as well, his family and her family and their shared friends. But it's hard for her to do that, you know.
Well, I think she's not ready to accept that he's not there. So she's not surrounded by the daily absence, you know, because she could just be elsewhere. And there is also a sense, which I definitely think you know, anyone who's had a bad breakup or saying there's definitely a sense of self-wallowing that's kind of, there's a comfort in that. There's, yeah. At least it gives you a purpose.
Yeah.
And I definitely felt, you know, quite tenderly towards her in that. Mm. Yes, of course, annoyed at times, as we all get around, like, come on,
put yourself together,
already, buck up, you know, like, but, you know, but it's her process and she needs to go through it. One of the things that when she starts reconnecting with people, she, like, you know, like spring unfurling and any olive branch of hope that begin, she meets a very magical character. So let's introduce Frank.
Yeah, because the book's about him in some ways as well.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Frank is a retired magician. He spent his life traveling the world doing magic and has retired from that and lives in Brighton and runs a book club. And, you know, everyone in the book club, you get the sense that they all have the reason that they met Frank. And you don't know what everyone's is, you know what some of them's are, but Frank kind of holds them together and creates this little community of people that he welcomes Holly into. I don't know, he's a bit of an odd one. I think that, you know, a few people have said to me, like, wait, is he actually magic? And, you know, it depends, you know, how you define that, I guess. But he certainly creates a lot of space for Holly and, like, creates a lot of safety for her and, you know, a new home for her in a time when she's kind of run away, I guess.
Mm. I was going to say, sort of like, I don't know if you know the character Auntie Mame, Mame Dennis, and she is sort of this, it came from a book written by Patrick Dennis about, you know, supposedly Mame Dennis, and it was made into several movies. And she is this sort of magical Svengali person. Mm. And she says, you know, life is a banquet and most poor suckers are starving to death. And you just got to live. And everyone should have an Auntie Mame and everyone should have a Frank.
Yeah. Know? And I think, like, no, it's interesting. I was also, so the person who died was my mum's dad, my granddad, who was called Sydney. And my dad's dad was called Frank and I never met him. And Frank, my dad's dad, is like a bit of a family legend in like our nuclear family, because everything anyone has ever said about him is that he was just this amazing person. And especially towards the end of his life, me and my mum's dad, my granddad, were very, very close. And like, actually, I think we had a friendship. And I think that I was struck by the fact that we had this kind of intergenerational friendship and he was that so much older than to me. And the grief I felt for him, it was familial, but I also really felt that I'd lost a friend. Frank isn't either of those people. You know, I didn't meet real life Frank to be able to write real life Frank, but there's starting points, right, for these characters. And I think that there's magic in grandparents, and I think that there's magic in having like older people in your life who just see you more clearly than you do and treat you with respect anyway, which I think is something that Frank does. He just takes people where they're at, you know, and he probably could be like, ugh, you know, or like have judgment, but he doesn't. He looks at you and he's like, okay, that's what you need right now, you do you. And that, I think there's something about that I certainly felt from my grandparents too, you know.
I think there's something in what you say about that intergenerational thing, because I have a friend she's much older than I am. She's the same age as my father, 88 or 89. And there is an acceptance and a non-judgment, because your friends now experience, you know, as your same age, experience what you experience, experience the expectation of friendship in the way you experience it, experience disappointment in each other in the same way you would experience it. Whereas someone with more experience has, like Frank, has the longevity and the longer view of like, you didn't show up today, you'll show up tomorrow.
Exactly.
It's not about me. You know, whereas especially in our 20s, it's very difficult to see, it's not about me. Mm. You know, that is something that I think comes with more age experience and also less need of each other.
Yeah.
And just more appreciation of a presence in your life.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true.
Yeah. So did, getting back to, you're saying the grief that you felt that you were writing this out of, did the writing of this expiate that grief for you in any way?
Do you know what's weird is that I didn't identify what I was feeling as grief until like maybe even after I'd written the book. Like, I think that because in our society, and you know, whatever you want to call that, Western society or UK society, I don't think we necessarily like name grief unless a person dies. I think that we have an understanding of what grief is if someone dies. But then people experience grief in all kinds of settings. People grieve a job, you know, people grieve a house that they move out of, and people definitely grieve themselves after trauma. And so because I guess I'm not accustomed to naming it as such, I'm not sure I identified it as such. It just struck me further down the process of my own recovery that I was writing about grief from a place of grief, and that I just hadn't necessarily married the two. But it's definitely a fictional piece, and Holly's not me. Like, we're very different. But to write, I think to try to write emotion honestly, you have to be able to access that emotional place. And certainly, I think writing through that emotion of like intense loss and chaos through Holly, I don't think I could have written that unless there was some processing happening personally as well, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I wanted to ask about the book because Sam is, his family background is originally from Africa, and he speaks Yemba and French. And she writes to him, or sort of speaks in her mind to him in French.
Sometimes, yeah.
Sometimes. What, from the reader's perspective, what does that, I mean, because I'm a French speaker and reader, okay. So it, you know, it didn't have any, it was seamless for me. Mm. But I imagine for people, and I always, when I read books where there's a language I don't know, Hungarian, for example, or whatever, I just wonder what I'm missing.
Yeah.
You know, when I get, because I know what I'm get, I know the extra that I'm getting when I do know it.
Yeah.
What's your experience of that as a reader and as a writer?
Oh, so a couple of things here. I mean, one is that I don't imagine Holly and Sam speaking in French or Yemba whilst he was alive. Mm-hmm. So I think that she finds ways of making life hard for herself as a way of trying to access him, like, since he's died. And for me, I think she has access to French quite readily. It's an easy language to access and to learn, and that this is work that she's doing as part of her grieving process, is that absorbing this language and finding ways of communicating, often quite poetically, in that language is a way of, like, of struggling to access that. But I think generally, actually, as a writer, like outside of this novel, I'm really interested in multilingualism, because there are many, many, many people in the globe who exist in a multilingual way, where language does flow seamlessly from one another. And I've lived in London my whole life, which is a multilingual city. And
especially Croydon. I mean, yeah. as an immigrant myself, I spent a lot of time at Lunar House. You know, it's where we all go.
Well, yeah. Ooh, what a horrible place. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Lunar House, I meant, not Croydon, which I love. I think that, and so that I'm really interested in, like, a multilingual existence and what language how language code shifts, how language flows from one language to another in a person with a multilingual brain, I guess. So I think that I didn't push that far in this book. I think it's something I'm playing with much more in my writing now. But certainly I'm I think also because French is very accessible, someone could look that up. And I guess it depends whether for them, for that experience, it's like, oh, they're having like a secret chat now, which is what my agent said. She said she never read the French because she doesn't speak French, and she never looked it up because she enjoyed that she couldn't understand it. She enjoyed being shut out from it, as a like, this is a Holly and Sam moment. But I guess that depends on the reader.
Mm-hmm. And talk to me about your path to writing. And something like we don't usually identify with as grief. Most people don't identify with themselves as poets either. So talk to me about your writing a bit.
I guess when I was younger, I wanted to be an actor, and I did act professionally for a little bit and did that and decided it was an industry that I didn't want to be in. And I've always written like in my room or on public transport, just as like a thing that I did. And I think when I stopped acting, I wanted to find the thing I'd loved in acting in a different way. And so I started to take my writing more seriously. And one of the ways I did that was by going to lots and lots of poetry and spoken word events in London. And they really became my community. And I tested my words on open mic nights and in slams and through the spoken word community. And that was kind of where I found my feet as someone who wrote. I think I still struggle to say, oh, I'm a poet or I'm a writer, because I'm not sure. I think it's something you do, you know, not necessarily something that you are. Well, for me, that's true anyway. But I, you know, the first book that I had published was a book of poems, and I still write poetry and, you know, do poetry projects as well. So I definitely think this book straddles genres a little bit. There are parts of it that I feel I was attempting to do something like a prose poem does with. And its form as well, I think, is quite poetic because it's very short chapters and kind of strange play with image and musicality of voice, maybe, which I definitely found through writing poetry first.
Well, and that's interesting to me because that's sort of really a very organic and I imagine for you more comfortable way of getting into your words by speaking them as an actor would. Yeah. So sort of went that route for, as opposed to internally, it was sort of externally.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah,
I definitely think sometimes when I talk about my writing process in a workshop or whatever, I think people have been like, oh, that sounds like acting. And I think it's just natural because that was where I first trained in the imagination.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're writing, do you hear what you're writing as opposed to read what you're writing?
I definitely read it out loud as part of an editing process, 100%. And especially with this book, which I wanted to feel like spoken English, not written English, because it is Holly chatting to Sam. So I wanted the writing voice to sound more like oral than written voice. Down. Yeah. I think also, like, because I've directed plays as well, and sometimes I'll see what I'm writing like it's playing out as a scene. Like, I think I'm quite a visual person in that way, which maybe comes from the theatre or bits of TV or film or whatever. I don't know. It's weird. I don't think you necessarily know what your process is until you start engaging with what other people's process is, and you're like, oh, we do it so differently. I think that's definitely part of it.
Excellent. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Good luck with everything. I can't wait to see what comes next.
Thank you.